The bankruptcy of South Korean shipping giant Hanjin won't affect Jaxport, but it is raising questions about the future of international shipping here on the First Coast. A closer look just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast as well on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead, a look at the future of international trade at Jaxport. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast author Tim Gilmore on his book, looking at the disgraced former Trinity Baptist Church pastor Bob Gray. Plus, Culpepper on sports as the Jags lose in San Diego. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, Jaxport handled 8.2 million tons of cargo last year from around the world and is the leading container port complex here in Florida. At the same time, news that South Korea's Hanjin Shipping Company has filed for bankruptcy has caused some turmoil in the global transport industry. That got us wondering what it all means for the local economy. Well, this morning we're pleased to welcome Jerry Malott, who heads the Jax USA Partnership, and Nancy Rubin, Communications Director at Jaxport. They join us now with more about the future of international trade here in our area. Good morning to you both.
Good morning,
Good
Melissa.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions for Jaxport when it comes to trade, shipping, and more? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on Facebook. Nancy Rubin, let's begin with you. As you speak for Jaxport, what's the reaction at the port to the news that Hanjin has sunk into bankruptcy? How is that affecting operations at our port?
So I would say initially that we in the port business, we're used to these kinds of changes. They seem dramatic on the surface. And in a way, you know, you can look at it and say, all businesses grow, contract. All industries grow, contract. This is a sign. Some of the shippers are consolidating, becoming more efficient. The ships are getting larger. As far as Jaxport, we have been growing in the container business by adding new services, new lines. Hanjin has not sent containers through Jacksonville in a number of years, and the coalition that they were part of will be bringing the extra volumes now through Jacksonville. So The answer to your question is, while we're watching and we're carefully examining what could happen, right now we are in a good position to continue to grow, to continue to bring jobs and opportunity through the container trade. And we're earning a name in the North Florida region as a destination for imported cargo. And, you know, I think that's in a large part due to the efforts to bring household names here to the area.
Jerry Malott, Amazon recently announced the plans to open a Northside distribution center. That was one big win for the business community. As you look at the big picture, how do you see international trade fitting into growing jobs here in this region? And what do you see as the biggest opportunities and the biggest worries?
Well, it is a real important part of what we do, and we have had a number of projects in the last several years that will be utilizing Jaxport as part of it. Amazon is the really big name that's coming here, and they're coming here with a pretty big center. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean they'll necessarily import everything through Jaxport because they have this huge national and international system, but we think we're going to get a decent amount of business from that project and from others. You know, an interesting thing that I just became aware of in the last 6 months is that in spite of the fact that we're doing really well here, there's somewhat of a global slowdown in logistics. The amount of goods being moved around the world has slowed down, which led to the Hanjin deal. They were highly leveraged and didn't make it. I hope there won't be others, but there always could be. We just haven't fully recovered from the recessionary period we had globally. And at the same time, we are building these monster ships everywhere. So capacity's down. I mean, the number of goods being moved around is down. Capacity's going up as these ships come online. So it makes for an interesting thing. But we're lucky because Jaxport actually in all of this, by adding services, has been adding business that others haven't had.
Then, Nancy Rubin, bring us up to date on where the port is with its plans to deepen or dredge the St. Johns River down to a depth of 47 feet to accommodate these bigger ships. that the port and other East Coast ports are going to try to attract?
And you say try, Melissa, but really they're here. What happens is a number of these larger ships that call on us regularly can't come as fully loaded as they would otherwise, as they will when we are deeper. The plans continue. The plans are based on future growth, on the need to remain competitive, and to serve the ships that are calling on us now with more cargo on board. When we leave cargo in states like South Carolina and Georgia, instead of in Florida, specifically here at Jacksport, we're leaving the jobs and dollars in those states as well. Because what they'll do is they'll put those goods on trucks and bring them to our citizens. We say, let's bring that cargo in through Jacksonville. So the plans continue. You may have seen recently we welcomed our three new large cranes to Blunt Island. We are nearly complete with the help of the Army Corps with the Mile Point project, which does allow these larger ships to come into the harbor more of the day, more hours of the day. And so the sort of strategic planning for these growth projects leading up to the deepening are all coming to completion, and the next step is to begin the deepening project.
It was recently reported that the legislature has approved millions for Jacksport, about $10 million for this deepening project. How will the rest of the money, where will the rest of the money come from?
So this is a multi-year project, as all large civil works projects are. So you're talking 5-6 years worth of budgeting to be done. We are in a position when we have more information, as you're asking about the rest of the funding for this large project, to get started. The conversations with the state are continuing. The conversations with the local government is continuing. We're on our way, though, and the sooner we can solidify our competitiveness in the larger ship industry, the better off the region will be.
Jerry Malott, what would you say to critics of the plan, the environmental voices, and also those who question the expense that might go into this project?
Well, the environmental studies have been done by the Corps of Engineers, and they have repeatedly said we are in line. There may be minor tweaks, but this is not a project that should cause any significant environmental damage, and on the other side will cause tremendous positive gains. You know, we have to remember we've already dredged a fair portion of it into Mayport Naval Station. So the Navy started the project several years ago and completed it. So we're just going to complete what they've already done into Mayport on down into the main part where Blunt Island is. It's a really positive deal, and the money's the big issue, of course. I mean, it is a lot of money. Fortunately, the state is going to help make it happen, but we're going to have to pay them back a portion of that.
And that seems to be the big unanswered question. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Where will that pot of money come from? How will this be raised? How will this be accomplished?
So as you know, Melissa, the state has been very supportive of the growth of all of our major ports. They recognize our position in this state is so incredibly strong from a location standpoint, from the standpoint of attracting businesses like Jerry has, large household names with significant impact on the economy. And they're not going to let that go by. They are not going to let this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to play a major part in international trade go by. So thanks to the support of the governor and the FDOT secretary, we're going to continue working on the funds because the return on investment is there.
So you'll ask the state for more?
The state is on board. They said that we're in. We want to make this happen.
And I think $50 million is actually on track for the first year, the first full year, which is next year, I believe. Maybe it starts October 1st. From the state. But they, because it's a multi-year thing, it's not like having to come up with that huge amount of money all at once. And the state will be there for us, just like they were there for Miami when they did it.
What are your questions for Jacksport and the Jacks USA partnership? The number to call in is 549-2937. Rhea is in Palatka. Rhea, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Hi, I'm fine. I'm a consumer, and I love the cheap Chinese junk. It's made life better for everybody. But we're growing up now, and they tell us to buy made in America stuff. And we're also realizing that a lot of that stuff pretty quickly ends up in the landfill. And there's, so that was one point. Another point is that the Northwest Passage is opening up north of Canada as the sea ice is definitely melting. There will be a new Panama Canal up there. And then my third point is, who can trust the Corps of Engineers in the state of Florida? And so that's all I had to say.
Okay, three points of skepticism. Nancy Rubin.
So to address the first, you know, when I talk about the port growth and people say, why does the port have to grow? I say we are all consumers in this country, the number one consumer nation in the world. Not only that, but to address your concern about goods made overseas, in order to support manufacturing in our own backyard, you must have a strong transportation, logistics, warehousing, distribution center, and port complex. You just have to. We are all so tied to the international business of trade. There is no rolling the clock back to where we wouldn't have to have a strong port. And a strong port means having the infrastructure, the ability to compete worldwide, and that's what we're all after.
And let me, I'm just going to quote from a recent column in the Times Union about this, get you both to react to it. The money for this has not been forthcoming, even with two longtime members of Congress representing Jacksonville, Andrew Crenshaw and Kareem Brown. They are both gone now, and their replacements will be newbies with zero pull. He goes on to say, Jaxport is anticipating trade with Asia will skyrocket. Tell that to Hanjin, the South Korean shipping company, seventh largest in the world, that just went belly up and filed for bankruptcy. What about those concerns?
So I'm going to let Jerry talk in a second, but the question of Hanjin, again, is not, we're not going to get that cargo. Who's going to carry that cargo? It's a contraction of the business. The cargo will still come, and a number of those containers will still come through Jacksonville.
Jerry.
Well, there are lots of questions on the table now, but first of all, we are continuing to try to bring manufacturing from China and other places to the United States. We just had a company by the name of Hans Mill commit. They've already bought a building. They'll go into production and start producing products that would have been made in China here next spring. We're finding that all over. We used to not be in the hunt for many global manufacturing places, but we are today. I would tell you that GE Oil and Gas, which is producing pressure gauges and valves and other things at Cecil, one of the options was to do that in Mexico, and they chose us rather than going to Mexico. So I think we'll continue to see more manufacturing come here. And in regards to the issue of what happens when the product is disposed, it wouldn't matter where in the world it came from. You have that same issue to deal with. If we get a Northwest Passage, shippers will find it. But it isn't there today, and it will be some time before that would occur.
Let's go to Bill in Riverside. The number to join us, 549-2937. Hi, Bill. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, where does it leave the city of Jacksonville if all of your hopes and dreams and predictions are wrong about the environmental impact or the economic benefit or, worse, both?
Okay. What about that? Both those points have been raised repeatedly throughout this process, Nancy. There's a lawsuit from the Riverkeeper over this. People who are skeptical of what you're saying think that the port is overpromising the benefits and underselling the cost.
The predictions of growth in the world trade, it's going to have ups and downs, as we're talking about. The strong, educated prediction of tripling in the container business through the United States is not going to go away. We continue to consume. We continue to trade globally. So the economics of it is based on information, projections, and I will tell you, fact, because in the last 5 years, we've grown jobs connected with the container trade by 57%. That has already happened. So when folks say the dreams Bill, respectfully, when you suggest that, you know, this is based on a hypothetical situation, no, there is fact. There is precedent. There has been incredible growth at the port and in the North Florida region because of the business that Jaxport brings. Jerry alluded to the environmental studies done by the Corps. They have used world-renowned models, models that have been used elsewhere successfully. You know, everything in life comes with a balancing of what you know and the risks that you want and have to take in order to grow. And sometimes you have to look at the priority of human beings as well as a natural resource. And as Florida grows, third most populous state in the nation today, as we grow, as this area grows, we're going to need jobs for everybody. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the conversation, Melissa. And sometimes we need to come back to that as well.
How many, and I know that this figure has been talked about for several years, how many jobs do you both estimate will come over the next years if the port is successful in this project? And what are you anticipating?
So I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the direct jobs are the ones that we'd be most interested. So let me talk to you right now. There are 30,000 individuals who are credentialed to come through the gates of Jaxport on a daily basis. That's a lot of people who, if the port shut down tomorrow, would not have a place to go to work, okay? They come and go, they're credentialed. Then those jobs throw off all of the indirect jobs in the region that are associated, the warehousing jobs, the trucking jobs. So the jobs to come with the container business directly, the direct mm-hmm. jobs, is in the 20,000 range. Mm-hmm. You're adding that to the jobs that exist today.
Let's go now to Jay in Riverside. Hi, Jay. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Okay.
My question is, if this dredging is such a good idea, I mean, these Republicans are always talking about the free markets. Why don't the businesses pay for this dredging instead of the taxpayers?
You know, who wants to take that one? Thanks, Jay.
Well, Jay, we have highways that we as taxpayers don't very directly pay for. We pay a small gas tax, but it doesn't come even close to paying for the highways. You know, there are infrastructure. We've decided in our country, and to a large degree in the world, that the infrastructure provided for airplanes, for shipping, for cars. it may not be true in railroads because I think they pay their own way today, but they didn't when we began the process. I think we've just decided that that's how things are going to happen and get paid for in our country. And shipping is one of those important elements that says if we're going to be able to move goods around the world and have it and play a role here, we're going to have the facilities to be able to do it.
And we're getting lots of tweets. Let me and we'll go back to calls for Nancy Rubin and Jerry Mellott in just a minute. Here are a few tweets for you. What is the status of the LNG terminal? Will it be supplied by a pipeline? How safe is that?
So our LNG business, we're pioneers in the LNG business for the maritime trade. There are several companies, the two large Puerto Rican carriers who have invested in ships and equipment to use LNG as a cleaner fuel of the future. And there are plants being built very close to the port to supply that LNG.
Okay. And go ahead, Jerry.
And LNG is a very, very different and very safe fuel because it is extremely cold. It's not flammable. If you had a bottle of LNG and you poured it out on the table here, it would lit a match, it would do nothing because it is in a frozen state. It's only when it becomes a gas that it has the potential. But it's been proven to be very safe and, of course, will be handled with extreme care at the same time.
And here's a follow-up tweet. I've heard that only the LNG industry is interested in these larger ships. Is that true? And who are the others?
Now, the larger ships that we're talking about are predominantly container carriers. Those are the big metal boxes that carry all of our goods.
And LNG is liquefied natural gas.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
I should have said that.
Good catch. I will say also that many of your listeners will know that we're one of the nation's largest auto ports as well, auto handling ports. Mm-hmm. And the larger auto carriers need the new locks of the Panama Canal as well. And so I'm learning that all of these consolidations in the industry, the move to larger ships is to make them more efficient, more cost effective. We need to be able to support them. And I'm just going to add one small point to what Jerry said. As a nation, we have decided that economic prosperity for our citizens is what we invest in when we invest in the infrastructure.
A very important point of on LNG, it's an extremely clean fuel. And the idea is that ships are now having to burn cleaner fuels when they get near the shore of any country. And switching to LNG, if it is not already a fully LNG ship, allows us to eliminate a lot of pollution that has been coming close to our shores.
We'll have to have you back again soon to talk about this, but thank you so much for being with us. Jerry Malott with JAX USA Partnership and Nancy Rubin of JAX Port, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We have much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper as the Jaguars hit a new low in San Diego. But up next, pedophilia and abuse inside a local Baptist church. Author Tim Gilmore on his new book next.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
On the next Fresh Air, Brett and Rennie Sparks, the Handsome Family, best known for their theme music for season one of True Detective.
From the dusty mesa.
We'll talk about their new album and the desert geography and mood disorders that have contributed to their sound. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Do you have music you want people to hear? Do you have an artistic vision you want to share? Then join these winners in the square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit your work now through September 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Hey, what's that?
That's the sound of music, David.
The movie?
No, it's WJCT's After Hours programming. You know, Indie Endeavor, Blues Horizon, Electro Lounge, Ring a Bell.
Oh yeah, I knew it sounded familiar. That reminds me to thank you listeners for always remembering us. We're throwing a concert hosted by yours truly.
And me, and Andrew Wickman of Blues Horizon, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at Unity Plaza. And yeah, David, I know, you have a problem remembering.
Welcome back. Well, in 2006, the Reverend Robert Gray, builder of Jacksonville's first megachurch, was arrested on charges of sexual molestation of children. Though Gray died in 2007, enough facts emerged to show that Trinity Baptist Church had covered up dozens of cases of its pastor's pedophilia for decades. This sordid and tragic tale is told in a fascinating new book. Author Tim Gilmore joins us with the story inside, Devil in the Baptist Church. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. This is your 13th book and probably the most important one yet in terms of looking at this cover-up of the abuse of children in a local church. Can you tell us what led you to write about this?
Sure. Well, it's been knocking around in my head for a number of years, you know. I did have quite the fundamentalist childhood, and I actually attended school there in the late 1980s. And so when Gray was arrested in 2006, and then there was tons of news coverage, you know, for that year and the next year until he died awaiting trial, You know, it was pretty captivating and both shocking and for some reason not shocking. And so it's been bouncing around in my head for quite a while.
Why was it not shocking?
Because I think there was such a, you know, a number of people have called it a kind of cult atmosphere, but I think it's actually common to a lot of fundamentalist churches that there is this idea that, you know, anything outside of the church is the world. And there was this saying that you're in the world, but not of the world. And so anything that was the world was evil, and anything inside the church, you know, was good and constantly under attack. And so there was kind of a paranoia there that, you know, just when you get out of it and look back at it, was, you know, there's something very strange about.
How in this environment then was the pastor Gray able to, as we learned, operate with impunity? Mm-hmm. And is it accurate to say that once the church learned of the abuse, they covered up the abuse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I was surprised to find out that it had happened earlier than the one time I had known about. It actually, you know, the story almost came out, or at least parts of the story, in the early 1980s. And Gray was sent away for counseling at that time, although, of course, that's not what, you know, the congregation was told. In 1992, a number of victim stories almost came out. And, you know, victims were finding out that they weren't the only one, that there were other victims. And
how many victims altogether we know of?
We don't know. About 24 people, you know, came forward, but there were other people who never did. And, you know, I spoke with the current pastor, Tom Messer, in preparing for this book. And I was surprised that, you know, that he did speak with me. And he mentioned, he said 20 or 30 or 40 victims or however many there were. That's mm-hmm. the actual phrase that he used. So, you know, I don't think we'll ever know.
Wow.
But 1992, he was, you know, the church met with victims and victims' families and asked them not to go to the police, to have it dealt with inside the church. And he left the pastorate and was sent actually out of the country as a missionary to Germany.
So in that sense, the Baptist church was not altogether different from the Catholic Church in the way that the Catholic Church hierarchy for many, many decades covered up the abuse of children by priests, and instead of holding them accountable, just sent them somewhere else.
It's shocking. You know, when I saw the movie Spotlight earlier this year, I think I saw it after it won, you know, its Oscars. I was just, you know, floored by the parallels, the similarities.
Well, then what is it about a church environment, in your view, whatever denomination it is, that can lead to this incredible abuse of trust and the ruining of children's lives, the absolute decimation of their psyches?
I think that's a really important question, you know, and I do want to say that I respect people's faith. You know, a number of people spoke to me who had invested their lives in Trinity, had, you know, had attended there and even worked at the school for 15, 20, 25 years. And they still have their faith, but they, you know, they'll be angry for the rest of their lives, I think, at the church. You know, I think that when you have someone who has that much power and it is, you know, people can't question it. I mean, if you are the man of God, and I do say man because, you know, he amongst many other things he preached against women having, you know, much power at all, including, you know, wearing pants. But
oh, wow.
But, you know, when you're the man of God, then you are, you only answer to God. And I think that, you know, while that seems like that should take care of plenty of things, you know, you can't be challenged by human beings or human institutions.
What have some of the children who are now, I take it, adults, said to you about this as you've come out with this book?
You know, A lot of people have said that it's, you know, I was hoping that this would be the case. I was worried about, you know, dealing with wounds that are still fresh in some ways because, you know, I don't know that scar tissue can ever fully form over things like that. But a lot of people have said, you know, the story has to be told, and it's actually helped them in terms of their own personal healing.
Just the fact that it's public.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And now Gray died before he could be held accountable.
He did.
But no one else was ever charged? Nobody else that knew of the abuse?
That's correct. That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about that?
Well, I will say that a number of people who were involved in the church then and who were loyal attendees and churchgoers, you know, felt very strongly that that something more should be done, and they told me that they were told not to contact any kind of authorities. And when I did meet with Tom Messer, you know, the conversation ended with his telling me, well, with my asking him, "Did you ever think you should go to the police? Because you're telling me you knew what you knew." And he didn't answer the question and stood up and shook my hand, and that was the end of the discussion.
Mm. But what do you think
what
about?
What do I think?
Why? What do you think of prosecutors not investigating others that, as you're reporting in this book, knew
right.
that children were being raped, and this went on for decades.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think
how many knew?
How many? And I don't know the answer to that, but a lot of people knew, and so well, I'll say that anyone who enabled that and helped it continue, including by sending Gray out of the country. I mean, if he had, the earliest allegation went back to 1949. So his moving to Germany, I don't know why that would, you know, keep him from molesting children in Germany. You know, I think anyone who knew, you know, bears responsibility. So sure, I think prosecutors should have gone after them.
In recent weeks, too, we've learned that a minister in South Georgia, Ken Atkins, who was speaking out very vocally against updating Jacksonville's human rights ordinance to cover LGBT citizens, is now facing charges of sexual abuse of children.
Right.
And so we see this, we've seen this with clergy across this area. We've seen, as you mentioned, the movie Spotlight. We've seen it around the world with the Catholic Church. At the end of that film, when they showed how many denominations worldwide had a problem with pedophilia among priests, it was absolutely mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing.
And so what's the main message you hope people get from your book?
Oh, the main message. Well, let me just add real quickly to what you said. You know, there is a whole web of abuse that's out there. You know, if we had time, I could talk about a number of other fundamentalist pastors. And there is a small section in the book where they're mentioned. Chicago Magazine did a story a few years ago called "Let Us Pray." P-R-E-Y, that discussed a number of ministers who had gone through a Bible college in Hammond, Indiana, which is a suburb of Chicago. The main message, you know, I hope that when we tell stories like this and when we break silence, that people who think that they could get away with doing things like this, or people who think that they could cover up others institutionally when they do things like this, we'll know that, you know, these stories are going to get out, and you know, and that silence is not an option.
He's author Tim Gilmore. The new book is Devil in the Baptist Church, Bob Gray's Unholy Trinity, and he will be doing a reading and signing this Thursday night at 7 p.m. at UNF's Gallery of Art. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
Thank you. On the next Diane Rehm Show, in about a week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will make their case for the White House. A preview of the first presidential debate, what the candidates are likely to discuss, their strategies, and how the debate might affect the dynamics of the race.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJZT.
WJCT is a community-supported station, and your contribution helps programs like our radio reading service for those who are visually impaired or have difficulty handling printed materials. If you'd like to specifically help radio reading, denote that on your check and send it to us at WJCT, 100 Festival Park Avenue, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202. And thanks for helping us give voice to the printed word.
If you're looking for the best blues show, look to the Blues Horizon. Each week, join me for the best blues, both classic and contemporary. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT 89.9 FM radio. Take a ride with us to some unknown places of musical light and shade. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 FM. So many roads.
Welcome back. Well, a day of TEDx Talks is coming up soon on the FSCJ campus, and the theme this year is Engage. Engage, with a focus on downtown Jacksonville. TEDx speaker Alicia Bauman and executive producer Jennifer Gray here now. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. This is coming up Saturday, October 8th, and Jennifer, tell us about this theme, Engage.
Well, when we were deciding on our theme last year, we wanted to go with something that we thought deeply spoke to our beliefs in TEDx, which is getting people involved in ideas, issues, and communities. And it also very nicely reflects the mission of Florida State College at Jacksonville, mm-hmm. which we've been doing a lot of work to engage more deeply in the community lately. Uh-huh. So that was where we went with it, and we're very excited.
Yeah. Now, Alicia, you're one of the speakers. You are an FSCJ graduate. What is your talk going to be about?
So I'll be speaking about spreading positivity forward through hashtag with love Jax.
With I love Jax.
With love Jax.
With love Jax.
Yes. So the idea, the movement is to spread positivity, unexpected messages through the community through chalking sidewalks or leaving random positive messages on people's cars and things like that.
Is this something you came up with? Are you doing this yourself?
Not myself. My day job is working for City Year, and it was City Year AmeriCorps members who brainstormed how could we infuse positivity and hope in our community that we're serving. So,
are people doing this as we speak, like chalking sidewalks and leaving notes on cars all over town?
Yes, yes. So we started in March, and we've done it a few times since. And if you look at the hashtag today, you could find some things. Now, other groups have taken over the hashtag, but it's all positive.
Very nice. So random acts of kindness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the TEDx is the whole idea of it is ideas worth spreading. Mm-hmm. And since TEDx has come to Jacksonville, so many interesting people have talked about so many topics. Now, the FSCJ event is its own event.
Correct.
Let's explain how that works.
Okay. TEDx is actually, the X is usually the flag that that's an independently licensed event, which means we work under, you know, the approval of TED, but they are not necessarily directly responsible for what we're doing. This is our third year actually doing it with the college. This is my third event with the college. We're very excited. This year we have 9 speakers, 2 FSCJ alum, 2 FSCJ faculty, and actually 2 people who are alumni of First Coast Connect, Mark Mervin and Rana Abdul-Jawad.
Oh, okay.
Are both going to be speaking with us this year.
And how did you, is everybody speaking around this theme of engagement?
They are. It's not necessarily going to be a direct line, as with many TEDx themes and the themes for TED. The idea is an umbrella idea. So they can be speaking on many different topics. We have someone talking about destigmatizing the mentally ill. We have Alicia obviously talking about paying positivity forward. We have a bunch of different things that'll be tied together with Engage.
And the cool thing about TED Talks is once the person is done talking, that talk lives on the internet, the video of it forever.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Our goal is eventually to get, we have all of our previous year's talks linked from our website, which is TEDxFSCJ.com, but our goal is to get picked up one day by, the overall TED.com and get
How
featured
hard
on
is
there.
That to do?
I'm imagining pretty hard. I don't actually have any statistics on that, but given the number of TEDx events that run around the country and around the world every year, and there are only so many videos on that site, it's pretty tough.
So there's a real competition, but if one makes it on to the TED website, they can go from maybe a few hundred or a few thousand views to millions.
Exactly. We'd be doing backflips. We'd be so excited.
Yeah, that would be so exciting. Mm-hmm. Now, this is coming up Saturday, October 8th from 9 to 3. Can you tell us how everybody can be part of this?
Okay. Well, you can go to our website, which is, again, tedxfscj.com, and register through there. Our registration did open this morning, or else you can hunt us down on Eventbrite if you want to do that. Again, our theme name is Engage. We also have an event that's sort of a kickoff part of our lead up to Engage. We did a photo series over the last 6 months, four photographers, one of whom is a student photographer. We did about 70 portraits. That's going to be opening this Thursday, and we will have a registration station open at the downtown campus gallery when we open from 5 to 8. So they can come and visit us and see our portrait series and get registered there as well.
Are you nervous at all, Alicia?
Absolutely.
You're a little nervous?
Yeah, I'm a little nervous.
Because it's my understanding with these TED Talks that a coach works with you and Everything has to be letter perfect.
Yes, yes.
So you're doing that now.
I do love my coach, Jeff Hess. He's the best. But I've spoken a lot in front of people, but not in this platform. So I'm excited, but also extremely nervous.
Oh, you'll do great.
Thank you.
It's TEDx FSCJ's Engage event, Saturday, October 8th. Producer Jennifer Gray, speaker Alicia Bauman, good luck. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And in a moment, Culpepper as the Jags hit a new low in San Diego. That's in a moment.
The boss. Some very odd things are happening in your town, and we need you.
It's Odd Squad Live, Saturday, November 12th, 2 and 5 p.m., Florida Theater.
Team up with Odd Squad agents in this live interactive adventure to solve an exciting case. Well, what are you waiting for? Go!
Odd Squad Live, Saturday, November 12th, 2 and 5 p.m., Florida Theater. Tickets at floridatheater.com.
When Larry came home to Alaska from Iraq, he relied on the VA.
VA kind of made this promise that, you know, they're going to take care of me.
And they did, until Congress tried to reform it.
With this new program, if it's working somewhere, I don't know where, but it's definitely not working here. It's probably the worst thing that's happened to veterans' health care in Alaska.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars hit a new low in San Diego.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper's here to tell us about what's going on in sports and whether Gus Bradley's job is at risk. Good morning.
Good morning. I think Ron Burgundy might have covered this one and said, oh, not so good. I see you have your Ron Burgundy bust right here on the table.
Oh, yes, in the place of honor.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, the Jaguars did not stay classy in San Diego. A 38-14 loss. It wasn't really that close. And
I believe it's pronounced San Diego.
San Diego. Germans discovered it in 1904. The impact on Gus Bradley's job is pretty dramatic. The fan base, boy, it didn't take long on social media, which, of course, is where you're going to get the most vociferous and impassioned responses and thoughts.
Yeah.
There are cries for Gus Bradley's job right now.
Uh-huh.
Now, there were some fans, in fairness, that thought he should have been gone last year. He was given this year. It's not going to happen this week.
Okay.
If the Jaguars don't do something in the next two games, which includes Sunday's game here in Jacksonville against the Baltimore Ravens and then the London game in a couple of weeks against the Colts, with a bye week following, there's a slim chance that something could happen there if they have another performance like they did yesterday against San Diego. Outplayed, outcoached, out everything by the Chargers. Just absolutely a one-sided game.
Yeah.
This year, as I've been saying for the last 6 or 8 months, is a referendum on Gus Bradley's coaching approach, which is different than a lot of coaches around the National Football League.
How so?
Well, he doesn't, you know, the old school Tom Coughlin authoritarian coaching approach, some think doesn't work anymore in the NFL. There's a sliding scale from Tom Coughlin and maybe Bill Belichick on one end, who have had success and are old school coaches, to the ultimate players coach. And Gus is certainly down toward the players coach end of things. He wants to remove distractions and remove obstacles. He wants everybody to feel like they're pulling together in the same direction. It's a wonderful concept if you think about the way that a locker room might work, but I'm not sure it works with so many young players. I think it works better with veteran players who are internally motivated, who will go out there and be professionals. And the Jaguars have some of those kind of players, but they're still a very young team, and a lot of these guys just don't know how to behave in the National Football League in terms of preparing for games, preparing their minds, and preparing their bodies.
So you're saying that these young guys need someone who's going to come in and crack heads?
Well,
typically
what happens when you change coaches is if you have an offensive-minded coach and the offense is the defense is struggling and you lose, you go find a defensive-minded coach. If you have a authoritarian coach and you're losing, you go find a players coach and vice versa. So when you think about going from, say, Tom Coughlin, offensive-minded authoritarian, to Jack Del Rio, defensive-minded players coach, right, that was sort of that kind of a change.
Mm-hmm.
Gus Bradley, defensive-minded players coach. So now you kind of go back to going in a potentially different direction if that move is made. There has only been one team in modern NFL history who started 0-4 and made the playoffs, by the way.
Oh.
And that is the San Diego Chargers in 1992. Only 12% of teams who start 0-2 make the playoffs. So the Jaguars are 0-2 now. Quick injury update. Kelvin Beachum, the left tackle, was taken from the field on a stretcher. He stayed in a hospital overnight for observation. They were concerned about concussion symptoms. It seems he will be okay and should be traveling back to Jacksonville this week. Next up, of course, it's the Ravens, who are 2-0 already on the season, so it doesn't get any easier.
Yeah, sure. And on the college front, everybody commenting, as you said, over the weekend about their favorite teams. Let's run them down.
All right, let's start with Florida State, who had almost as bad a weekend as the Jaguars did, losing 63-20 at Louisville. It's the most points Florida State has ever surrendered, and it's not necessarily just that they surrendered that many. It's with the expectations and the setting and the way it looked. Louisville looked like they were playing twice as fast as Florida State. This now gives the Seminoles no more margin for error if they want to make the Final Four. They basically have to win out and do it impressively to do so. Florida, on the other hand, easy win over North Texas. Bad news there, though. Gators starting quarterback Luke Del Rio, Jack Del Rio's son, left the game with a knee injury, sounding like it's a 2 to 4 week situation. Florida goes to Tennessee this week, and they'll go with Austin Appleby, a senior transfer at quarterback for the time being. Georgia came from behind, beat Missouri, behind freshman quarterback Jacob Eason. Good sign for their future. JU scored 28 in the third quarter to beat Edward Waters and give new head coach Ian Shields his first victory at the school.
Very nice. And you're the voice of the Armada. They will return home this weekend.
Yeah, after a wild 3-3 draw in Puerto Rico, it'll be the first time the Armada are back home in a month. They'll take on Rio OKC, and they'll finish the season with 5 of the last 7 games at Community First Park.
Always follow Cole on Twitter, and the podcast you do with Sam Kavaris is pretty popular, too.
Yeah, the Sam and Cole podcast?
The Sam and Cole podcast.
How did we come up with that name?
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Richard. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Piotr Chevchik. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And next on Diane Rehm, in about a week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will make their case for the White House. A preview of the first presidential debate. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.